Welcome to the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology's Counting the Earth podcast from a quite cloudy and cold riverbank in Oxfordshire. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. In this podcast, we look at nature and the environment, but always through the lens of one number. And today's headline figure is 2,104, the number of non-native species of plants and animals, which of course includes insects, that have established themselves in the wild in Great Britain. In this podcast, we're looking at the uninvited flora and fauna in our countryside and what happens when they start to cause problems and become invasive.
Later in the podcast, we'll be talking to Dr. Olaf Boy from the GB Non-Native Species Secretariat, the government body that tries to manage the more destructive new species. But here with us now along the riverbank is UKCH ecologist Professor Helen Roy, who leads several programmes in the UK and globally to understand and predict the impacts of biological invasions on biodiversity and the ecosystems that they colonise. We used a couple of terms in our introduction there that I think are worth digging into a little bit. First off, so for example, non-native species and invasive species. So firstly, what does non-native species mean?
Definitions are really important, and non-native species are species that have been moved from one part of the world to another part of the world where they would not naturally occur, and they've been moved by humans. And it's that human part that's really important. So we can think about, for example, the species that have been planted in gardens, like Buddleia, for instance, or Himalayan balsam, that then escape into the wider countryside. So they are the invasive non-native species. So these are species that are a subset of all of those non-native species that cause some kind of problem. So there are many of the non-native species that are not causing any problems, but those that do are really quite destructive.
And it's very specifically introduced by human beings, is it? It's not as a result of maybe the climate becoming warmer or wetter in certain places, and so you get more plants of a certain type.
Absolutely. So it's to do with the human action. So we know that species are on the move. We know that with climate warming, some species are expanding their range and heading northwards. That's a natural range expansion. So we're not including those species within this definition. We're counting those that are species that have been moved by humans, either intentionally, because they've been planted, for example, because people love to see them, or unintentionally, they might have hitchhiked alongside people, for instance.
It's interesting you say hitchhike, because I thought, is it all the Victorians' fault?
Oh, not at all. In fact, you know, we can look over decades and we can see that there's been a huge increase in recent decades in terms of the numbers of non-native species arriving around the world. And we can see when we picture a graph, for instance, this huge upturn, this huge tick in terms of the numbers of species in recent years, because we're all moving around the world more, we're moving goods more around the world, and alongside some of the species are coming too.
Of all the non-native species that have become established here in Great Britain, what do we tend to see the most of? Is it plants or is it animals?
Plants really dominate. So of that big number that you revealed, probably about 1,600 are plants and the rest are animals. But interestingly, when we look at the proportion of those species that cause some kind of damage, it's more than a third of the animals that go on to cause some kind of problem. That is, they're an invasive non-native species, whereas a relatively low percentage of the plants, so sort of 7-8% of the plants, cause some kind of problem.
You touched on a couple of ways in which these non-native or invasive species can actually get here. Are there other ways?
There are so many different ways in which non-native species can arrive in a new region. And actually, interestingly, these, as we call them, pathways of arrival are changing over time, because we see fashions change over time. So one of the things we're worried about at the moment is that people are trading ants online. People are buying ants as pets.
That's, you know, this is crazy, sorry.
Ants are amazing, I will say that. So absolutely fantastic. But really, it is worrying to think that they're being traded through the internet and people are setting up their own cultures at home as
pets.
So
is this by collectors in the same way people collect larger, like snakes and scorpions and things like that?
It doesn't necessarily have to be collectors. It could be somebody who just has a whim that they want to keep some ants, in the same way as in the past they might have kept some other kind of exotic pet. So that pet trade route can be a way in which species are introduced. And of course, many pet owners are incredibly responsible with their pets and they look after them very well and they keep them close to home. But it's when they escape, for instance, that it can become a problem. And for example, raccoons are another species that are kept by people.
Sorry, Alice and I are both smirking here.
I just find the concept of having a pet raccoon quite strange.
I'm jealous.
They're very charismatic, and I suppose that's one of the problems, is where you do have these cute, cuddly, charismatic species that people understandably want to keep. But raccoons are quite notorious for being very good escapologists. They can get out of almost any situation, so I suppose that's exactly why there may be more of a risk.
Absolutely. And this can be the problem with some of the species that we introduce, for instance, into a garden, or we introduce them as a pet. If they are good at escaping, then it's very likely they are going to escape. And when we think about some of the plants, for instance, that have amazing ways in which their seeds can disperse, then it's perhaps not surprising that those seeds get carried over from someone's garden into the wider countryside. And no one's intending for that to happen. It's just an unintentional consequence of introducing some of these species into captivity. Some of these non-native species arrive unintentionally. So, for example, they might be carried in the ballast water of ships, and then the ships discharge that ballast water coming into ports. And alongside that discharge are lots of little teeny tiny creatures that come out and can survive in their new environment. Of course, many of them won't be able to survive, but it's those few that can begin to sustain a population and then potentially spread and potentially go on to cause some problems.
I think many people know, for example, that the grey squirrel is originally not native to here, even though we see it everywhere, and it's become a sort of, you know, part of who we are and what we expect to see when we go for a walk. Are there any plants or animals that might surprise us that we think of as native but are in fact non-native?
Well, perhaps rabbits is a good example in that case. So we're all very familiar with seeing rabbits around us, and many people really love to see them.
Well, Peter Rabbit is a massive part of many people's childhood, isn't it? Beatrice Potter.
Absolutely iconic. Yeah. But of course, rabbits were introduced by Romans a long, long time ago. So they've been here for a very long time. It doesn't really make any difference. Fact is, they were still introduced by humans. But I think it is really important to remember that there are many loved non-native species by people, and they're not causing any kind of problems. So it's really for us about the focus on those invasive non-native species that in some way or other are threatening biodiversity, ecosystems, or the way we live.
What kind of harms, what kind of damage are we talking about with these species?
There are many different ways in which these species impact other species or indeed ecosystems or us. So there are some species that have human health impacts. So for example, the giant hogweed, that if somebody brushes by it and gets their sap on the skin, it can cause blistering in the light. It has a reaction with the light. And then there are other species that are outcompeting other species. Maybe, for example, a plant that smothers other species, or they may be eating one another. Some species will transmit disease, and we're becoming more and more aware of the problems with disease being transmitted by these invasive non-native species.
I've got to know the harms caused by a raccoon compared to an ant.
Raccoons can be really problematic in terms of they can be a problem around dwellings, for example, going through the rubbish. They can also spread diseases. In terms of the ants really worry me, because they are what we would call ecosystem engineers. So when you have an ant colony, it can really totally alter and disrupt the ecosystem in which it now finds itself. And there's some really fascinating studies that I could tell you about the ways in which they alter their behavior when they're in their new range. So suddenly, for example, their chemical communication breaks down. They stop getting aggressive to one another and to neighboring colonies, and they form super colonies. In some cases, some ant species can do that.
It's not just damage to biodiversity and ecosystems, though, is it? Japanese knotweed, I suppose, is an example of a species that causes damage to human infrastructure and actually can have quite an economic impact.
Absolutely. As a number of these species have an economic impact. And sometimes when I'm travelling into London on the train, I'm amazed at how much buddleia I see alongside railway tracks as well. And this can be a problem for the railway people who are trying to keep those railways clear. So there can be these direct impacts on economies as well.
If we turn our back to the river now and look out in towards the woodland, not many flowers at the moment, mostly green in front of us, but can you tell from these leaves if there are any non-native species here?
what we're seeing in front of us really dominating the vegetation is this swathe of Himalayan balsam. And it goes for as far as we can see along the riverbank in both directions, and it's going really far back as well. It's not in flower at the moment, but it won't be very long before it has some very, very pretty little purple flowers. And the seeds in those flowers can just ping off and be transported along in the water, and that's why it's spreading so well.
That's why you see them along riverbanks, yeah. And you're right, I wouldn't have known, because I love Himalayan balsam, even though you're not supposed to, because it's so beautiful. But I would not have known that all these green leaves among the nettles here were Himalayan balsam. Would you, Alice?
No. Is that how it got here? Because it's so beautiful, people planted it in their gardens?
Absolutely. And it is a truly beautiful flower. But unfortunately here, and you can see it before us,
it's everywhere.
It's really dominating. And there's nothing much else that can grow through it. The nettles are coming through in places. But other than that, all we see is Himalayan balsam, the nettles, a little bit of goose grass, and a few strands of other grass.
So that squeezed out a lot of native wildflowers, effectively.
Also, not only that, but it's interesting to think what's happening below the ground. And in this case, it's destabilizing this riverbank. It's got quite a shallow root system. And so it's displacing some of the plants that would hold together that riverbank. So there'll be greater erosion along here as a consequence of that Himalayan balsam.
Let's wander a little further along the path, away from the nettles and the Himalayan balsam. And hopefully, Helen, you'll be able to point out some more invasive species as we go along.
I'll use it as an excuse to get my sweep net out and look for a few insects as we go along.
Now, you do look like a Victorian butterfly collector. I must admit, that's an enormous net.
It's made of a kind of canvas. It's very, very robust. It's got a very robust ring that's holding that canvas open. You can see it's very well worn. I take it out a lot to be looking for insects.
So you sweep it, you said?
I do. I sweep it. So I'm literally going to swish through, actually through these nettles, because nettles are a fantastic source of early aphids for insects. I'm looking for harlequin ladybirds. So these were first reported in 2004, and then they spread at about 80 to 100 kilometres per year. Imagine a tiny ladybird spreading at that speed.
How can you tell a harlequin ladybird from a native ladybird?
So there are about 50 species of ladybird in the UK. And the harlequin ladybird is on the larger side of the ladybirds. It has brown legs and it has white markings just behind the head on either side of a structure, a little plate that's called scientifically the pronotum. And that's a very good identifying feature. And sometimes it has a black M shape on that marking as well. So it is really quite distinctive. And I'm always happy to look at photos. So if people send them through to the UK Ladybird Survey, I'll take a look and confirm them.
Have you caught anything yet? Or
no,
do you need to do a bit more sweeping?
A little more sweeping, I think.
Excellent. Right, let's keep walking.
This is a very exciting time of year for entomologists, because as the aphids increase in number, so do all of the other insects that feed on those aphids, including the harlequin ladybird.
Yes, so this is sort of the thing that ladybirds are famous for. They're the gardener's friend because they'll eat the aphids off your roses. Are harlequin ladybirds kind of as effective as native ladybirds for this, or not really?
Harlequin ladybirds are amazing at eating aphids. They're incredibly voracious predators, but the downside of them is that they will also eat other things as well. And one of our native ladybirds, the little two-spot ladybird, and the two-spot ladybird is much smaller, it's not so competitive, and the harlequin ladybird just feeds on them.
You kind of mentioned the records that we have of these ladybirds and the fact that we know they're travelling so fast. Those records come from the public, don't they?
They do. It's been an inspiring story, really, from a little ladybird that arrived in 2004 and caused us a huge amount of concern. And we knew that there was nothing we could do about it. There was no effective control that we could take. All we could do, really, is watch it spread. But we engaged people in watching it spread. And as a consequence, we have this amazing data set all across the UK showing the spread of the harlequin ladybird. But what was really wonderful was people also recorded other species of ladybirds. So we were able to do some amazing analysis to look at the effects of the harlequin ladybird on other species of ladybird.
And another insect that has been causing a problem in the UK and the public are playing a role in looking out for is the yellow-legged hornet. And UKCH was involved in developing the Asian hornet app. So the yellow-legged hornet was previously known as the Asian hornet. Is that another kind of public success story and somewhere where the public can still help?
Following on from the Harlequin Ladybird Survey, which really demonstrated that people would get involved in tracking an invasive non-native species, that really encouraged us to think that we can do this for other invasive non-native species as well. So we have a list of species, so-called alert species, which we ask the public to report any sightings of, and that's all available on the Non-Native Species Secretariat website. And we're so fortunate in Britain to have the Non-Native Species Secretariat coordinating our activities. And the yellow-legged hornet is one of those species, and it has been a phenomenal success story because, unlike the harlequin ladybird, there is something we can do about the yellow-legged hornet. So at night time, all the hornets, the hundreds and hundreds of them, go back to their nest and stay in their nest overnight. So once that nest has been found, it can then be removed, and all of the hornets removed with it. So there is effective action that can be taken. But what's really important is that we have very rapid early warning, and that's what people have been amazing at providing their potential sightings. So just only right at the beginning of May, we've already had hundreds and hundreds of potential sightings of yellow-legged hornet. Thankfully, in most cases, they are not yellow-legged hornets, but we are able to detect which ones are and then give that information to, for example, the National Bee Unit, who can take action on the ground.
Citizen science monitoring projects like that are playing a vital role in mapping populations of invasive species and so helping to facilitate their control and even eradication. As you mentioned, Helen, you can go to the GB Non-Native Species Secretariat website to find out more about these projects, and they really are at the heart of this fight. Earlier, we spoke to Dr. Olaf Boy from that agency, and I started by asking him to describe what the organisation actually does.
I'm part of an agency of government, and we help to coordinate action on non-native species across Great Britain. So we try to make sure that everyone is joined up and that we help to make that coordination work both across government and with the stakeholders who are really important for dealing with non-native species in Great Britain. And that includes the general public, it includes people like Wildlife and Countryside Link and RSPB and the Angling Trust and all the different bodies that can help us to tackle invasive non-native species in Great Britain.
So can you give us an example then of how serious an issue it is?
Just to take the economic example, we think that non-native species cost the British economy something like £2 billion per annum. So, you know, really quite significant economic impacts. And then from a biodiversity impact, there's all sorts of species, native species and habitats that can be impacted by invasive non-native species. So if you think about, say, the American mink, which can badly impact on water vole populations, or things like rhododendron, which can spread across woodlands and displace native species and really change the whole sort of ecosystem there.
So how is it that the Secretariat is tackling these issues?
Perhaps the first and most important thing that we try and do is identify what the serious problem species might be and try and prevent them from getting established in the wild in the first place. So prevention is better than cure in many cases. And we're really trying to stop the new harmful species from getting in and establishing. Of course, we won't be successful in all those cases. So then if things do get in and they start to establish in the wild, it's really important that we try to detect them and then rapidly respond to them. So that's a really important part where people can help us detecting these species that might turn up in the wild. And then, of course, there are some species which are already, you know, widespread and causing problems. So in those cases, there's a range of different options available to try and deal with those. We have some really fantastic community groups across GB. So these are local action groups that go out and volunteer to try and tackle some of these species, perhaps along a riverbank or something like that. So we have these really impressive groups that help to do a lot of strategic work locally. And then more nationally, with those sort of widespread species, there are other things that can be done. So DEFRA and the Welsh Government, and I think Natural England as well, help to contribute to a fund that looks for biocontrol agents that can help to try and tackle some of these species as well. So you might have heard of a psyllid, which helps to try and control Japanese knotweed. We have our new non-native species inspectorate, which is based at the Animal and Plant Health Agency, which is the same agency that I work for. And their job is really to facilitate that prevention role. So they're really trying to look for the new species that might be coming in, trying to stop them either being sold or traded or kept, and also trying to stop them getting into the wild. If they do get into the wild, the new inspectorate will help to try and respond to them as well. So, for example, they are helping to respond at the moment to a plant called the purple pitcher plant, which is a carnivorous plant It's actually been deliberately planted in SSSI bogs and mires in the country at the moment, and the inspector is helping to try and make sure it gets removed.
I can't believe that. People would actually go out and plant non-native species in the wild deliberately.
Yes, it's a strange one. I think some people seem to think it will enhance the environment or something along those lines. But for some reason, people seem to have actively planted these plants. So that's part of the really important reason this is a partnership approach. We really want to make sure people understand that this is not a good thing to do and that they should not be putting their plants into the wild, you know, either accidentally by allowing them to escape out of your garden and certainly not deliberately by dumping them into the wild or deliberately planting them in places.
That's slightly blown my mind, that one. I just never would have occurred to me that somebody would do that. Now, we know in terms of established non-native species, it's a number for this podcast episode, it's 2,104. But that number doesn't necessarily take every non-native species into account, does it?
So yeah, that's a good point. So those are the ones that we think are established in the wild in Great Britain at the moment. And I should say it's UK CEH who really do a fantastic job of gathering those data and trying to crunch the numbers, because it is quite a difficult task to work out exactly how many of these species that we have and which ones are established. But of course, there are species that turn up in the wild and then don't establish. And there's many thousands of species that could get into Great Britain in the future. So there's lots of species that are not yet established in Great Britain, which are a lot of the ones that we're worried about in terms of preventing them from getting here.
One of the species that we're currently trying to prevent getting a footing in the UK is the yellow-legged hornet. UKCEH was very heavily involved in the development of the Asian Hornet Watch app. What does that app and the work that the public do mean to the work that you do?
There's been a really amazing amount of work on this species by the Animal and Plant Health Agency, and particularly a team called the National Bee Unit. First of all, there was some really good work done to assess the risk from this species and understand that it's a potential threat before it was even first detected in Great Britain, and then put in place a contingency plan so that there is a team ready to respond to the species if it did turn up at that point. And then we've had huge support from stakeholders across Great Britain. So particularly the beekeepers across Great Britain are really highly vigilant, looking out for this species and helping to report it. The app is vitally important. And Helen Roy and the team at UKCEH have done a great job of developing the app and managing the system that allows the data to come from the general public and the beekeepers in particular into the sort of central systems. And then that goes to a team in the Animal and Plant Health Agency called the National Bee Unit. And if it's a suspected Asian hornet sighting that comes through, they'll go out into the field and they'll try and track down any potential nest that might be there. So it's a really comprehensive kind of approach to trying to make sure that Asian hornet doesn't establish in the country.
What other species are causing maybe the biggest problems at the moment, or the ones that you in particular, your secretariat, worry about?
In the secretariat and across GB, you know, a lot of our work and a lot of the things that we worry about are the new species coming in. So the kind of future threats, Asian hornet or the yellow-legged hornet, I should say, being one of those. But there's actually a wide range of species that are a potential concern. That's one of the fun and interesting things working with invasive non-native species, is they come across all different taxa and environments. So you could be dealing with a marine species one day, or a freshwater species the next, or a terrestrial plant the next. So some of the species that we really worry about are things like the raccoon dog, which surprisingly people keep them as pets. They're actually now regulated, so there are laws in place to stop people keeping them.
We're going to have to describe this.
It's essentially a sort of small, stocky dog with raccoon-like colouring. It's a canine. It's much closer to a fox than it is a raccoon, obviously.
One was on the loose in Wales quite recently.
Yes.
Why would they be a threat?
They are actually invasive in Europe at the moment. So they were introduced, actually, I think, into Russia, a European part of Russia, perhaps by hunters to then hunt for fur. And they started to spread into continental Europe. So they're in Scandinavia, they're in parts of Germany. And they are causing problems. They're predators of birds and small vertebrates, so things like amphibians and things. And they're also quite important vectors of disease, potentially. So things like rabies can be vectored by raccoon dog. So we're concerned about them as a potential species that could establish in Great Britain.
We've talked a lot about established species and species that might become established, but are there any successes. Have there been any species that we've already managed to eradicate in the UK or in GB?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's successes on all sorts of different fronts. So, you know, eradication is certainly one of the things that we would attempt to do for some of the most harmful species where we can, where it's actually feasible to do so. For example, Natural England actually led a really great piece of work to get rid of the American bullfrog from the southeast of England, which was really starting to establish there sort of in the late 90s, I think it was early 2000s. And they did a great job of getting rid of the American bullfrog, which actually, if you look at the continent in Europe, American bullfrog is a big problem for quite a lot of countries there. So we've managed to nip that one in the bud and save us quite a lot of problems down the line by dealing with that one quickly. There are eradication programs that are ongoing as well. So not yet completed, but we're hoping that we will be able to get rid of some species. So things like the water primrose, which is a small ornamental pond plant, has bright yellow flowers, comes from South America, is hugely invasive in places like France, where it can really smother and clog up waterways. So it completely changes the ecosystem, and it also causes problems for drainage and things like that. The Environment Agency have been leading an amazing campaign to try and spot it in the wild in Great Britain and then respond to it if they do find it. So for at least 10 years now, I think they've been kind of detecting new populations and getting rid of them where they can. The problem with that is that they're finding new populations all the time, so we're having to bring those new populations under control. But that's one where we really need people to be on the lookout and reporting something that might be water primrose. So there's identification information on our website, and you can find the links to iRecord and places like that to send in records of that species if people do see it.
Often if you do see an invasive species, be it Himalayan balsam, and there are other things like parakeets, I was used to just seeing them all the time in London and parks. Well, I live 25 miles outside London, and for the first time ever, I've seen parakeets. How do you get across why something which could be very beautiful is an issue?
It's a complicated question in some ways. First of all, it's important to say it's the invasive species, which is about 15% of the non-native species that get established in the country are the ones that cause a problem. So it's the ones that cause problems that people need to be aware of. And it is quite difficult to raise awareness of these species. So that's one of the reasons we have Invasive Species Week, is to try and get people thinking about it, get people out and about and understanding what the potential problems might be associated with some of these species. And yeah, when you see things like Himalayan balsam on the riverbank, it might at first appear, quite pretty and quite nice. But of course, when you start to get invasive species that really dominate in the landscape like that and really take over habitats, there's always a risk that they will start to displace native species and disrupt native systems. And that's the kind of thing that we need to be aware of and wary of, and trying to make sure we don't allow that to happen. Because the more and more of these species that we get into the wild and into the countryside, the more risk there is that we're putting our native habitats and species under pressure.
As it's Invasive Species Awareness Week, what can the public do in general when it comes from all these different areas? It could be soil, it could be freshwater, it could be plants, it could be deliberate. What should we do?
So Invasive Species Week is our main opportunity to try and raise awareness of invasive species. It's really important that people are out there and thinking about what invasive species might be present in their area and the potential problems that they cause. And what we're really asking people to do is five things. Be aware, try and help spot species that might be in your environment. There's identification guidance on our website, and you can record species through things like iRecord. So send us pictures of things that you think might be non-native to help make sure that we're keeping track of what's going on out there. Help with biosecurity. So that's things like cleaning your boots when you go for walks. If you're kayaking in a river or using a boat or angling or something like that, make sure to clean your equipment down afterwards. And you can find information about our Check Clean Dry campaign online, which is all about trying to improve our aquatic biosecurity. Try to make sure that your garden plants don't accidentally end up in the wild. So if there's a risk that something might spread out of your garden, make sure to contain that. Don't accidentally dump anything into the wild that might be from your garden. And of course, make sure your pets, so if you keep an aquarium or something like that, make sure that those animals or those plants don't get into the wild either. So don't dump things down the local drain or anything along those lines. And then lastly, as I mentioned, there are local action groups across the country, and you can get involved and help to volunteer to manage some of these species in your local environment. And you can find details of local action groups online and on our website as well. So I'd certainly encourage people to do that.
Our thanks go to Olaf Boy from the GB Non-Native Species Secretariat for talking us through the government's response to this growing threat.
Well, we've walked a little bit further along the riverbank, alongside what looked like a whole load of ducks over there. We're beside some trees which are hanging over the riverbank, and a bit of sort of quite calm water beside us, Helen. Are there any hidden dangers here in this what seems like a beautiful sort of tranquil picture of calmness and English countryside?
Yes, although we can't obviously see them at the moment, below the water will be a number of different invasive non-native species. So the signal crayfish is quite a well-known species, and this is one that we find along here in the Thames. We also find a variety of little tiny shrimps that have come from a region, the Ponto-Caspian region, in Eastern Europe. And they get carried along in people's fishing equipment and in kayaks and other things that people use around the waterways. And these little tiny shrimps can really cause a problem in terms of upsetting the community of other little invertebrates that are living below the water. And as we can't see them, they're very difficult to detect. But there are now a variety of different ways in which we can go about finding them. And one that's really exciting is the use of environmental DNA. So we have scientists within the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology who are using this technique to help us in detecting these invasive non-native species. So they can take a small sample of water, for instance, from a little area like this, take it back to the lab, and then have a look at what is in it in the way of DNA, and then match that to some of the barcodes that they have for different species, and they can then detect some of these invasive non-native species that way.
Considering the amount of Himalayan balsam that we walk past in order to get to this new spot, is the genie out of the bottle?
I think that I'm incredibly optimistic. What I think is really exciting is that globally, many, many countries have signed up to an agreement, the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. And one of the targets within that framework is to reduce the impact of invasive non-native species. So that's really exciting that the world has signed up to that. The world said it's going to take action to try and reduce the number of species that establish, that is, reach a stage where they can reproduce in a new region. And if we all work together, we really can make a difference.
You're playing a role within that on your work on island nations in particular. They're more vulnerable to invasive species as well, aren't they?
They are. Islands are incredibly vulnerable to invasive non-native species. So when we think about the big drivers of biodiversity loss, climate change, pollution, overexploitation, land and sea use change, and invasive alien species, they are the five big causes of biodiversity loss. And on islands, invasive non-native species are the really, really big concern. So when they arrive on an island, they'll often arrive where there's very unique animals and plants. Plants that aren't found anywhere else in the world, animals are only seen there. And then these invasive non-native species arrive, they outcompete these other species, they feed on them. They're a major cause of global extinctions on islands. That species lost forever. I've had the great privilege of working on all of the UK overseas territories, and these islands are just incredible. And just as an example, on the Cayman Islands, they have an iguana that's not found anywhere else in the world, a blue iguana. And they had a very, very successful captive breeding and reintroduction program, and we're really seeing this species thrive. And then unfortunately, a green iguana escaped from someone's pet collection and began to reproduce in the wild. And when I visited there back in 2018, there were thought to be about 1 million green iguanas. And the estimate was that the population was doubling every year. That's just phenomenal growth. And unfortunately, the green iguana impacts the blue iguana in a variety of different ways. It can carry diseases. There's also the possibility that it could hybridize. And so there's now real concern for the blue iguana. So on the Cayman Islands, they're undergoing massive control of the green iguana. It will be almost impossible with the ways of going about it at the moment to eradicate it completely, but it is possible that it can be contained to allow some space for the blue iguanas to continue to thrive.
Now, at the start of the podcast, when you were giving the definition of non-native species and invasive species and how this wasn't to do with climate change, but when you do have the number of species changing naturally as a result of climate change, does it not all work out effectively? I know this sounds like I'm being devil's advocate, but isn't this the way life goes on, in that some species will flourish and others won't? And this is just the sort of changing world we're living in.
For sure, we're living in a really rapidly changing world, but I think the worrying aspect is how fast we as humans are causing that change. So from all of these causes of biodiversity loss, all of which we're behind in one way or another, we're really accelerating that pace of change. And we will lose species as a consequence, and that will have all kinds of ramifications. And for me personally, it's deeply sad to think that we're going to lose species. And then, of course, there's issues around ecosystem resilience as a consequence of losing species that maybe have particular function in a particular ecosystem. And without them, that ecosystem can't function in the same way.
We also know that we rely on different ecosystems to perform services for humans. So do you think that this biodiversity loss could have an impact on us as well?
Absolutely. And again, thinking about the islands that I've had the pleasure of visiting, like St. Helena, for instance, in the mid-South Atlantic Ocean, there they're seeing a plant, New Zealand flax, growing all the way through their cloud forest, and that's having major implications to their water security. So yes, and food security as well. We're seeing species moving into areas where people are farming and then resulting in major crop losses and really affecting their food security.
Well, we've come to the end of our enjoyable walk, and I did enjoy seeing you sweeping. Did you catch anything, by the way, Helen?
I did catch a few really beautiful species. I saw a wonderful leaf beetle, had a little tiny mayfly, which I released straight away so it can go back and head into the river. No, it was very enjoyable. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Helen Roy.
When you are out in nature, you just see this sort of vista as a whole, don't you? The beautiful array of plants and all of the beautiful insects and the hum of their buzzing, and it's hard to separate those out into their separate elements and appreciate that actually not everything is working harmoniously with the flora and fauna around it. And some of these lovely species, actually, maybe it would be better for the environment if they weren't there.
Yes, and I'm reluctant as I am, because I'm a huge fan of Himalayan balsam. I think you can definitely see from the spread just along this riverbank how destructive it is, and how there were no other wildflowers, that's just nettles. And that in itself is worrying. But for me, I think one of the most surprising things about our chat today has been about the ants. I would never have guessed that. And I think I've got a pretty good imagination, but I was just like, no. But I think that to me is like, wow, there are aspects of invasive species and ways in which of getting them here that I had not even considered.
I think the thing that struck me most is actually how dangerous some of these species can be. You know, giant hogweed is an example of something that's harmful directly to human health, but also the biodiversity losses that can be caused by these species actually can cause food and water security issues, or prevent boats from transporting around. That it's not just something that impacts the environment, obviously that's also very important, but it's actually something that impacts us very directly.
And how we must all take these biosecurity measures. It certainly made me think now, when I go kayaking, and we do own a kayak, is that I have not done this, and I'm feeling incredibly guilty now, and that next time I'm going out, I am definitely going to rinse it down and dry it out.
I do think that's a really important message about what people can do. We can all take action to help prevent the establishment of these invasive species. So another campaign is Be Plant Wise. If you have a garden, a pond or an aquarium, make sure that you don't accidentally spread invasive plants into the wild. And obviously don't deliberately plant non-native species into the wild, even if they are beautiful. But also think about what you're throwing away. Think about how you are disposing of your garden waste, and make sure things aren't escaping over the fence.
And one of the messages I think both of us got from Olaf, the raccoon dogs, because I shouldn't laugh because I know it's not funny, but it's just, this episode has blown me away, quite frankly, and the number of things, the sort of did you know aspect of it. But do look after your pets and animals. Don't allow them to escape or release them into the wild. It's cruel to the animal, and it could harm our native wildlife.
And finally, join in. Record your sightings in surveys, use the alert apps, and volunteer with local action groups near you working on local invasive species management.
Thank you for listening to Counting the Earth. And a reminder of our headline figure today, 2,000 104, the number of non-native species of plants and animals. Please do join us next time for another look at nature through numbers.